coming again. You got that too? Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for February 9th. We have a very full agenda, as you can see today. What I'd like to do is start out with a continuation of the hearing on Senate Bill 1060. Now, we had people who signed up weren't able to testify, so we're going to give them 2 minutes each, as everybody else had 2 minutes. There were a couple people that came from far away that didn't know we were only taking leftover testimony, so we're going to have those folks come up as well. And I also am going to be handing the gavel to one of my trustee members here, because I am testifying on a bill next door. I want to let you know about the rest of the agenda here. We are going to follow the order that's listed. We're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 1031 first, which will be fairly short, I believe, then 1059, and then we're going to do 1036 before 1055. And you do see that we have scheduled at 5:30 the same, it's actually hearing room C for 1 hour. So chances are we're going to go over. We're going to run as long as we can in this room, and if we can't, we will probably reconvene tonight. I will certainly make that announcement, and then we have one more hearing on Thursday that also we can carry over bills. So with that, committee members, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1060. This is a continuation of the public hearing from last Thursday, and whoever, you want to do it? Okay. So, Senator Atkinson, I'm going to check in next door, and these are the folks that signed up in 2 minutes each. Beth is going to...
Just the yellow
and the next page.
Keep going.
Madam Chair, no testifying. Yeah.
Okay.
John Ledger. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll be back.
Call forward Mr. Ledger, Mr. Honeycutt, and Mr. Jillians. She opened up a public hearing?
She did.
Okay.
Someone getting Mr. Jillians? Okay. Mr. Ledger, go ahead and begin.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries, and I'll be brief, but this hasn't been covered yet on this bill. And that is, I think any of you that have floated go by industrial facilities where the banks have protrusions from them for water intakes and discharges. Oftentimes they're very large. Oftentimes they're dangerous. The banks may be maintained a certain way to control erosion, and access to the banks exposes the public in industrial areas to valves, weirs, tanks full of things you don't want them to be near, and it's generally, I think, a security hazard both for the public and the company. So we would suggest that this bill be made clear that there can be controlled access to the banks for commercial and industrial facilities, and in some cases it's required by Homeland Security that the industrial facilities have access and protection for their land. They know who's going in and coming out. And I think that's an important piece of this that's missing right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Honeycutt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, in opposition to Senate Bill 1060. Very briefly, the definition of floatable in Section 1 of this bill significantly changes what we believe the existing definition from Oregon Supreme Court case law is on that point, and will result in a number of streams that are currently not open to the public becoming open to the public under this bill. In addition, we have some significant concerns with Section 3, Sub 2 of the original bill, providing a defense to a charge of, to a criminal trespass charge for people who are using the river and then exit the river and go up off the banks and use adjacent property for continued recreational use. There's a broad definition of recreational use in the bill, and allowing someone to go upland and essentially engage in recreational use goes far beyond not only the Attorney General's opinion, but also all of the at least all of the case law that we can find on this issue. So we think this bill is a significant expansion of what current law authorizes, and would really provide significant intrusions on the rights of private property owners as a result. At least in its current form, we are very much opposed to this bill, and hope that if the legislature wants to address this topic again, that they do so in the interim with a work group that can dig into it again. I know there's been many work groups, but I think the language of this bill calls for one. Thank you.
Thank you for advocating another work group. Mr. Jillians.
Thank you, Mr. Vice
Chair. He can be chair, right?
Committee.
We can make Dave the chair.
Yeah, Dave's the chair. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I would echo the concerns that Mr. Honeycutt had with the bill. The definitions in here are a substantial jump from what the Attorney General's opinion meant as far as navigable, and now we're going to floatable. We're particularly concerned with incidental uses connected with public use. One section that Mr. Honeycutt didn't mention, which I think is in the dash ones and dash twos, which is section 7.2, which says a property owner may not unreasonably interfere with persons making public use and the continued use, and we're significantly concerned with that. At the danger of annoying the vice chair, I would say, Mr. Vice Chair, that we did have a sort of productive meeting yesterday afternoon, and this is the sort of topic that would be ripe for a work group throughout the interim. At the risk of having no life whatsoever, Mr. Vice Chair, I agree, because I feel like I'm on every single work group there is this interim. I really feel this is one of those issues. So,
Chair and Vice Chair.
with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is there any questions for this particular panel of task force advocators? Okay. Thank you very much.
Glutton for punishment. Okay.
Mr. Gallagher, Mr. Barrows.
Going up the hill and no soldiers behind me. I'll take the center chair, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Dave Barrows, representing Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway, and I've also been asked to speak for the Union Pacific. One hat. The other hat is the YMCA's. We have huge concerns about this, and incidental use is a particularly stressful thing because for the railroads, number one, we're not sure what that means, but for the railroads, people get on our right-of-ways way too much as it is now. And our main line runs along the Chutes River, and if people decide they want to portage around a particular rapid because they're just not competent to run that rapid, they get up on the main line, they put the rubber raft over their heads, and it may not be able to hear the train coming. And the train doesn't blow its whistle because there's no crossings in that area. So that's a huge concern. Section 11 in the dash twos would speak to the liability question that would face a private landowner. But it doesn't address the safety issue. And that's a concern, not an equal concern, but a grave concern for the railroads. For the camps, we do not particularly want people walking through our church camps because they've decided they run out of beer on the river and they know there's a store up on the road, and so they tie their boat up and walk up through the camp, which this would permit. And that's church camps, that's YMCA camps, that's camps of all nature that are on Class 1 waters or lakes. And we think that's extremely broad and extremely undesirable. And I thank the committee for its time.
I think, Mr. Barrows, that beer-drinking trespassers might have a life-changing experience on their way through a church meeting.
That's possible, Mr. Chairman, or they might just get some more beer and go back down to the room.
I'm
another possibility.
Any other questions?
You did.
Thank you very
Thank you very much.
Mr. Eisenberg.
I thought you'd be done by now.
We're cruising.
You're not here yet. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis with the League of Oregon Cities. I believe that the committee staff distributed our written testimony at the end of the hearing on Friday. So briefly, we would just like to state that we have some concerns about the definition of waterway, in particular lake, in the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, and that it includes certain artificial reservoirs. We want to make sure that that definition does not include municipal reservoirs that are currently closed to access for provision of drinking water, for instance. So we would advocate an amendment to exclude those facilities from the definition of waterway. Also, we just as the industrial and commercial users have stated that they would like to see explicit language making clear that landowners have the ability to restrict access to lands adjacent to waterways, we would like to see such explicit language in regards to public entities, in particular cities, along those lines. In particular, because Section 2, Sub 2 of the bill in regards to Class 2 waterways states that in order to for somebody to have public use of the waterway, they need to obtain explicit permission from the landowner unless the adjacent land is under public ownership. There are certainly places, well, fields, for instance, where it makes sense for public health and safety reasons to have restricted access. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Appreciate your willingness to come back, and we do have your written testimony. Okay, I'm going to go down the list and just ask everybody who is signed up to come up here. So we've already done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just,
so Tom Gallagher, not around. It's Helen and Dan Gillespie. Helen and Dan Gillespie. All right. Anybody else that has signed up? We have. I think that's it then.
Mr.
Oh, here.
Gillespie's.
Okay. My committee staff just went running out. Come on up, please.
Is this sworn testimony?
Yes, we.
That's not a problem.
I was going to say we won't make you.
No, we're not going to.
We're not going to ask you to swear. Don't worry.
Don't swear at us.
Yeah, and don't swear at us. Exactly.
I try never to do that.
But we will ask you to state your name for the record, and you each have 2 minutes. So, thank you for being here today. And this is about the waterways bill, so I want to make sure you're testifying on Senate Bill 1060?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, my name is Daniel Keith Gillespie. I live at 25725 Trask River Road in Tillamook County, Oregon. I've been a law enforcement officer for approximately 34 years in the state of Oregon. I'm currently retired. The last 10 years I worked part-time for the Tillamook County Sheriff's Office as a park security deputy. And my experience on the river has been that rather than show up with torches and pitchforks when somebody's having an emergency on the river, the locals usually show up with care and comfort and help them solve their problems. I had two young men show up at my door that tried to take their drift boat down around Peninsula Park. They failed to put their plug in the boat, and it sank and got stuck up against the rock, so I contacted one of my neighbors who had a chainsaw winch, and he spent his entire afternoon on a Saturday winching their boat out so that they could retrieve it without damage or harm to the boat or them.
I'm hoping those weren't my constituents, but it's close to my district.
But the only times I've had to cover in on problems with trespassing was when people were trespassing on the land on the lower river where they would park their cars, climb over the farmer's fences, and go down to property through property that was posted. If somebody's having an emergency on the river, everybody in the area is willing to mobilize and help them so that the damage to them and their property is at a minimum. You know, this bill just seems like a solution in search of a problem. It's. No, I guess I'm done.
Okay. Thank you very much. And would you like to say a few words and please state your name for the record?
My name is Helen Tippins. I'm a homeowner in Clatsop County, and I live on the North Fork of the Nehalem River. My home is on 2.5 acres with 350 feet of waterfront on the river. And it's my understanding, since it was purchased before 1985, that my rights extend to the middle of the river. And it is a permanent home. I'm here because I'm concerned about the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 1060. I'm a widow living alone in a rural area, and there are other women in the same situation, and they within about a mile of where I live. So my main concern is for security for myself and other homeowners on the river. I don't care to give carte blanche permission to cross my property to anyone carrying a fishing pole or a hunting rifle. I would certainly make exceptions for someone needing medical attention or, as Dan's friend happened, if they had damage to a boat or a raft. My concern is that the proposed language is too vague. It's too broad. It's my understanding that the changes in the bill would call for public use of the riverfront land for recreational purposes, and the section I read listed hunting, fishing, swimming, boating, camping, picnicking, hiking, nature study, and also did mention outdoor educational activities and volunteer work, public purpose. And so I just feel that that opens the door to unlimited use of private property. Thank you. Thank you, committee, for your time.
Thank you for coming here today. Any questions for the panel?
Can we have one more thing, ma'am?
Quickly, please. Yeah.
Yes. In the area that we live in, a response time of 30 to 45 minutes for the police is probably about average.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you both for coming here today. I know you've traveled far.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, then we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1060, and we have a work session scheduled
for Thursday.
Okay. Okay, next, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1031, and Beth, if you can provide us an overview, please.
Senate Bill 1031, you have a set of amendments in front of you, the Dash 2 amendments. We did get a no revenue impact statement on the Dash 2 and a minimal fiscal impact statement. With the Dash 2 amendments, Senate Bill 1031 would continue certain existing prohibitions on siting destination resorts in areas of especially sensitive big game habitat. The measure also deals with the effects of resorts on counties within certain distances of the resort, within and outside of the UGB, and the measure also deals with the applicability of these new provisions for destination resort siting.
Okay. So colleagues, committee members, and folks who are listening, folks in the audience, I wanted to just provide some background on this bill, because this is something that the chair has been working on since last session. I convened a work group of parties who have been involved with destination resorts from around the state, and this work group has been meeting just about every 3 weeks during the interim, and what you see in front of you is the product of that work group. It's a consensus amendment, I should say, since it's now an amendment, since we've had some changes. But this was many hours of input from representative groups. I wanted to first say thank you to the many folks who, some of them drove long distances, volunteered their times, others were paid to be there, but I want to thank everybody who was willing to roll up their sleeves, work together, and come up with what I believe is the first start towards longer-term reform on destination resorts. So I want the committee members, folks in the audience, and folks listening, and we did receive many comments. This is a first step. What we did is we made some adjustments to existing law, but I will tell you that the committee members, and you will hear from them today, are the work group members. This is an informal work group. It was not set in statute, an informal work group convened by the chair, that there is an interest to continue meeting to see for 2011 if we come up with some language that we can get some agreement on. So I wanted to first thank everybody. We do have many members of the work group that want to come up and say briefly a few words, since we have lots of other work in hand. And then I think Beth had mentioned that there's some comments that we received that are in the packet. So with that, I want to first ask Richard Whitman, the director of DLCD, to come up and also thank him for his time, because of course he's already very busy and I asked him to do yet another thing, but certainly appreciate your willingness to help out on this, Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and essentially on this effort, I acted as staff for the committee chair on this, and my purpose here today is simply to provide a very brief overview for the committee on the main provisions of this legislation. There are two main changes that this legislation would make to the existing destination resort siting laws in the state of Oregon. The first set of changes deals with the criteria that counties use to map lands that are eligible for the siting of a destination resort. The second set of changes have to do with a section of the resort laws that addresses the impacts of specific destination resorts as part of the siting process. So, and I've just handed out to the committee a very brief section-by-section analysis of the bill that describes these in a little bit more detail. But very briefly, on the mapping criteria, the first change has to do with especially sensitive big game habitat. Under current law, counties are not allowed to map lands as eligible for a destination resort if those lands are within an area that is shown as especially sensitive big game habitat on a July 1984 map produced by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Counties can add to that area, but they can't subtract from it. The work group recognized that having that static mapping of sensitive wildlife habitat doesn't really make sense now that we're 25 years later, and that there should be some process for updating such areas. And so the first change that is in the bill would allow a process for updating that mapping. The second change is an addition of a new criterion for siting destination resorts having to do with areas that are at high risk of wildfire, and basically would provide that if the resort, if a county is proposing to map an area as eligible for a resort within an area of high wildfire risk, they can do that, but they then must also plan in a community wildfire protection plan to reduce or mitigate that risk, either by treating the forest area or by providing additional suppression facilities or some combination of those two. So those are the changes in the mapping process for what lands are eligible for a destination resort. In Section 2, there are then two new criteria that are added for to address impacts of specific resort proposals. The first has to do with economic impacts of a destination resort and would authorize counties to require a resort applicant to do an economic impact analysis of the proposed resort. And then in subsection 4, there is a new provision addressing traffic impacts of proposed destination resorts, requiring a traffic impact analysis and mitigation of a proportionate share of the impacts of the proposed resort. And then in Section 3, there are provisions dealing with the applicability of these proposed changes in law that are intended to clarify. They're intended to really restate what the existing law is for, this is a term of art in land use, the goalpost rules. The main point here is that if a destination resort application is filed and a county subsequently amends its map after that resort is filed, those changes to the map will not affect and will not be standards for the review of that destination resort application. So the normal no moving the goalpost statute is intended to continue to apply. There have been some questions about that in Section 3 in the applicability clause, so I just wanted to state that for the record. There are a couple of other clarifications for the record also. One coming back to the wildfire piece, there are still some members of that informal work group who continue to have concerns with the wildfire issue as it applies to resorts, and would like to see those issues addressed if an informal work group continues on this subject. And then also on the wildlife piece as opposed to wildfire, just to clarify that the mapping that was done in 1984 is of winter, especially sensitive big game habitat for a winter range. That was the basis of the ODFW mapping that was done in 1984. So with those clarifications, I'm happy to respond to any questions that the committee might have.
Okay, thank you, Director Whitman. And again, I appreciate your work on this and willingness to help staff this work group, this informal work group. We're going to take time for some questions, and then I'm going to invite up folks who've signed up and members of the work group itself, so they may be able to answer some of those questions as well. Questions?
Yes.
Senator?
Thank you. Mr. Whitman, a couple of things before I get there. Are we going to have ODF&W testify on these, on this bill?
I don't know
if they're
so.
Here, but certainly we could get the question to them. They were there at the work group. But so why don't you see what the question is?
I would be very interested to hear from them. I'm looking at the dash two amendments, lines 6 and 7. If the State Fish and Wildlife Commission amends the determination, that language leads me to believe that if a county decided that they wanted to amend, they couldn't, and so most of the onus on amending that map falls on the department. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, that is correct. My understanding of the intent of this coming out of the work group is that the map could be amended only if the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission first signs off on that change. It would then also have to be adopted as an amendment to the county's comprehensive plan.
Okay, so in fact, we are putting Fish and Wildlife up as the ultimate decider on destination resorts. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I think it would be accurate to say that this provision would only allow a change to the existing mapping of especially sensitive big game habitat if the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission approves of that change.
Do you know, under this dash two, would it be permitted for some sort of a PUD to be placed on an area that would fall under this 1984 winter range map, or would that just fall not under this law and just fall back to a county to duke it out with the commission?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I assume you mean a planned unit development that is not being proposed as a destination resort, so a rural residential development of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
The normal non-resort rules would apply to that, and this particular provision dealing with the 1984 map would not apply to that proposal. I should note for the record, though, that the county might have its own mapping of wildlife areas that are identified as significant under the state land use program that could come into play, but not this provision with the ODFW map.
Thank you. And just one quick concern. The problem with the map is that the map was done not by biologists per se, but by politicians at the end of the 84 session, at the end of that year's session, I should say. And you have such gross mistakes in that map as half the city of Ashland is in the winter range of deer range. And you've got these massive swings that were drawn by politicians in 1984 that we're now living under that haven't been amended since. And while ODF&W agrees they're not the best maps, they're willing to spend millions of taxpayer dollars to keep those maps in place in court. And so I don't know if we're solving this when the county isn't going to take the lead and the agency doesn't want to fight the map and we don't have the guts in here to make them reassess the map. We've got huge, gross mistakes in the law as it's applied, at least in southeastern Oregon and southwestern Oregon. So that's one of my concerns.
If I might, Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I understand the senator's remarks, and I believe that this whole this was an issue that was discussed at some length in the work group, and I think there is interest in continuing to work on this issue to find a resolution that addresses some of your concerns.
Thank you, Director. Okay, I'm going to call up some other members that have signed up and members of the work group, Nick Lelak, Ann Hannes, and actually I'll also call up, I think, Sean Gillians, who is Sean here? Yeah.
That's our full-time work group member, isn't it?
Yeah.
You just put him on anything we have?
Yes. Okay, Sean's not here. So why don't I call up Linda Swearingen? You want to come up? And I'll call you up next, Sean.
Sure. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and with me today is Nick Lelak with the Deschutes County Planner. I want to commend the Chair, Senator Dingfelder, for your leadership in pulling this bill together. The Association of Oregon Counties does support this bill as amended by the Dash 2 amendments. We think it's a reasonable approach. The first step for changes to land use with respect to destination resorts. We also recognize that this being a first step, we're going to be working more on this during the interim for, in a collaborative sense, for any additional changes. Thank you. And let me turn it over to Nick for so that he can talk about his experience in dealing with destination resorts, because Deschutes County probably has had more experience with destination resorts than almost any other county.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Nick Lelak, Deschutes County Planning Director. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the bill and to serve on the work group. I think we've made significant progress on a number of issues. Since Deschutes County adopted its destination resort map and ordinances almost 20 years ago, our program has been more restrictive than state law in almost every regard. And what the Senate Bill 1031 and the Dash 2 amendments do is to more closely align the state law with Deschutes County's requirements. What I've provided is a matrix that in the column on the left shows sections of the bill, the column in the middle shows Deschutes County's requirements, and then I've provided commentary on the right. And I'd just like to make a few comments about four key issues. The first is the 1984 map. The key is current law is tied, as Director Whitman stated, specifically to that map. And while this amendment may not be as far as we would like for it to go in terms of changing that map, at least this is one step in that direction to provide some flexibility. And the result of that effort hopefully will be to create a more accurate map. And creating a more accurate map may expand or shrink lands eligible for destination resorts, and or maybe a benefit or a detriment to a specific site for a destination resort, but the outcome is a more accurate map. The second issue is wildfire. Deschutes County has seven wildfire community wildfire protection plans that cover our entire county. We take it very seriously in terms of siting destination resorts, and we go significant steps further when we work with resort developers and what we require of them, and those are outlined in the matrix as well. In terms of the economic impact analysis, we haven't talked about that yet. That is a new requirement that's proposed. Developers are going to propose prepare an economic impact analysis for any project that they are going to pursue to determine whether it's financially viable or not. We have required such an analysis to be submitted to Deschutes County since the inception of our program, and we don't just require that for information gathering purposes, which is the intent of this provision in the amendments, but we go a step further and we actually have criteria in our code that we evaluate that economic impact analysis on, and then we make findings to determine whether in fact the resort's going to be financially viable, it's a contributor to the community or not. So we think that's a good provision to include in the bill, and it'll be up to individual counties in terms of how they wish to implement that provision of the bill, if it's just for information gathering purposes or if it goes to the next step and actually ties criteria to that map, to the economic impact analysis. And finally, the transportation requirements. Again, we have required transportation studies as well as mitigation for resorts throughout Deschutes County. County since the inception of our program, and I've listed all of the requirements that we have, including the proportional share of mitigation within cities, et cetera, since that. The new provision is within 25 miles of a proposed resort. That can both expand a transportation impact analysis area and mitigation to include additional communities that may not otherwise have been studied, but by the same token, it may also limit the area that would be impacted by the traffic impact analysis. For example, if an intersection coming out of Gresham or Sandy or Salem or Eugene is tripped by a resort, this 25-mile limit would avoid having to extend mitigation measures to that point. I'm happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for serving on the work group. We appreciate your real-life experience and as we work through these amendments. Linda?
Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, I want to just first of all extend my appreciation again to Senator Dingfelder and staff, because in the very beginning I had some very serious reservations whether or not we were able to come up with something that I think makes sense.
And Linda, can you state your name for the record,
excuse
please?
Me. Linda Swearingen. I represent several different destination resorts. And again, I just want to mention that while we weren't able to include everything I would have liked to have seen to actually encourage some responsible development, I do think we were able to clear up some things that really did need to be addressed. And I'd like to answer Senator Atkinson's concern about the 1984 map. You are correct. In 1984, the map was put together basically based on elevation lines and based on what was the best science available at the time, and we haven't touched it now for several years. And we have had developers who have asked to have changes within that map based on science, and they have not been able to do so. However, for the first time, this would allow a process for a developer, if they choose to have the map looked at, they can contact the county, they can contact ODFNW and begin a process to look at the science for the county. You have to look at the entire county, not just at the particular piece of property that you're interested in, and see if it makes sense to make changes. It's very expensive. It's very time-consuming, and it probably will never be done. However, it is a step in the right direction as far as, for the first time, there is a process to amend the map. And I'm confident that over the course of the next year, we're going to continue to look at this and other things that impact destination resorts, and hopefully we can come up with some other changes that make sense.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to, I guess, restate what you all just said and get the counties to nod their head there. I think what we're saying is the 1984 map and destination resorts is kind of like dealing with wolf bills. Everybody gets torn apart on these things. But what you're really saying is that the -2 amendment would allow the developer and the county to work together, come up with a concept of amending the map, and then there's a mechanism to go to the state without redoing the entire state's map.
Yeah.
And you've defanged ODFNW and said, nope, we're only talking about this county, one of 36, versus, oh, it could cost billions to do this. So you created a mechanism in place, and I would mention that I noted now in two or three hearings that LCDC is getting much more friendlier, too, by the way. So.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. And we have Representative Wisnett's staff here. Megan, why don't you come up? Representative Wisnett and Representative Clem also sat in many of these work group meetings, so I do appreciate that. And Megan, thank you for being here. I know that the representative couldn't be here.
Right. For the record, I'm Megan Schoenwerk. I'm Representative Wisnett's legislative assistant, and I'm supposed to send along his apologies for not being able to be here today. He had a meeting out of the building that was already scheduled. The letter you have in front of you basically just states his support for this bill, and he just wanted for me to come down here and state his support. in getting this bill passed, and also just wanted to thank Chair Dingfelder for your leadership and efforts in the task force and having this bill crafted and moving forward.
Great. Well, thank you, and I appreciate the time you've spent. I think you're becoming probably an expert on land use issues for the amount of time you've spent there, so I look forward to continuing working with the representative as we move forward in the coming months.
Okay.
Thank you. We have several other members that would like to come up, and then some folks who were not part of the work group, but let's have Eric Kanzler come up. Sean Cleave, you wanted to come up and say a word, and I know Sean Gillian. The Sean Show. We're going to stick, you know, Eric in between you so we aren't Sean squared. Okay.
You might team up against me.
Yeah.
That's me.
Okay, which Sean wants to go first?
I'll be brief. Chair Dingfelder, for the record, my name's Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau is a strong neutral on the bill. We
really neutral.
We're here today to just thank the chair for keeping us abreast of the work group's progress and actually taking a very conservative approach in addressing some very specific issues regarding destination resorts sightings. I think this is a good example of a bill that could be handled in a short special session, and I thank you for having a bill that makes it a little easier on my schedule these next couple weeks. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and committee members. For the record, my name is Eric Kanzler. I am the Executive Director of Central Oregon Land Watch. So on behalf of Land Watch and also as a member of the work group that met for so many months on this issue, I'm here to express our strong support for the bill. As some of you may know, we had some concerns related to the wildlife mapping portion of the bill. Those concerns have been resolved by the Dash 2. It sounds like that may be an ongoing issue, and we'll continue to remain engaged in that as it moves along. Although the scope of the bill is narrow, we believe that it is a very good first step as we continue to work towards broader destination reform at the state level. We see the bill as addressing four matters of policy. One is it sets state-level standards requiring resorts to take measures to avoid or mitigate their traffic impacts. It sets state standards requiring resorts to develop wildfire plans in areas of the state where there's a high risk of wildfire. It sets standards for economic impact analysis that would include impacts to the county and also nearby cities. And it establishes what we believe is a fair and thorough process for updating the 1984 map, as we've already discussed. I think in each case, the bill recognizes an important matter of policy and takes steps to address it. So I will leave it at that. I'll thank the chair for her hard work and leadership on this issue. It's a pretty contentious land use issue, and it's no small feat that we actually have a bill before you today. So I'm glad to be a part of it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Sean, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Gillian's representing the Oregon Association of Realtors in support of the Dash 2 amendments. We also appreciate the hard work of the chair and Director Whitman and the hours that have gone into this process. We do think that it's a step in the right direction. Eric and I certainly don't see eye to eye on a lot of issues that I wanted included in the bill, and ultimately we've agreed to discuss them further in the interim. But I think the bill does allow counties to make more informed decisions on the impacts of destination resorts, and it does provide limited flexibility on the 1984 wildlife map, which we feel is important. Look forward to working with you in the interim, Madam Chair, on future issues, including the $7 million figure and a variety of other issues that we've talked about, habitat restoration and whatnot. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from the panel?
Well, I just think it's an observation. All three of them, none of them have gray hair, and the only person with gray hair is Mr. Whitman.
I keep it short so you can't tell that.
I also will say, Sean, that's the first time I've ever heard the word conservative and my name in the same sentence, so I thought that was pretty interesting description. But thank you, gentlemen, for your time and effort in coming here today. Okay, Steve McCoy, and are there any other work group members that would like to come up that didn't sign up? I'd like to say a few words. Okay, if not, I'm also going to call up Duncan Brown and Stephen Gaffori, and then we also have a couple of other folks, I guess, ODOT, but...
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Steve?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Steve McCoy. I'm representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on SB 1031 with the Dash 2 amendments. We support this bill. There are modest changes in the bill. It was done by a consensus work group, which we'd like to thank you, Chair Dingfelder, for convening and shepherding. And we look forward to more comprehensive destination resort reform coming out of that work group for the next session.
Thank you. Stephen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafoury. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, which comprises about 1,000 land use lawyers, land use planners, and citizens who are citizen commission members. We represent a large group of folks who have varying interests and varying philosophies, but have one thing in common, that is we're all concerned about high-quality land use planning for the state. I have with me Duncan Brown, one of our members, who wants to make some comments on this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Duncan Brown. I represent the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, OAPA. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify on the Senate bill. We have prepared written testimony, which you should receive in the next day or two. So I would like to limit my verbal testimony to basically two items. The first is the section dealing with wildfire protection. We really strongly support this particular section, but would suggest that not only the county be required to approve on a wildfire protection plan, but also the affected fire protection district, if in fact there is one. Fire protection districts are sometimes separate taxing entities and therefore semi-autonomous from the county. And basically they're the experts in wildfire protection, and we think that they it would be beneficial to include them. The second item that I'd like to strongly support are the economic analysis requirement and the transportation impact analysis requirement. We feel that those are, in my experience, which includes doing contract analysis for Cook County on several destination resort applications, participating in a number of other meetings and resort hearings in the Deschutes County area, and now participating in the mapping procedure. Those two items, economic impacts and transportation impacts, are by far the greatest concern of people testifying. We would, however, suggest that the requirement for a mitigation plan that is in the section dealing with transportation also be included in the economic impact analysis. There are many towns or unincorporated commercial areas within easy driving distance of the either proposed, approved, or existing destination resorts that are impacted, and we feel that a mitigation plan would allow those small cities to have a greater say within the Deschutes and Cook County area. Also, the impact area of these destination resorts often spans county lines. So as a result, we have one county in which a destination resort is proposed, and another county and cities within that other county that are impacted, and they have often very little say as to appropriate mitigation measures. We feel, though, that Senate Bill 1031 is a great step forward. We support it, particularly with these proposed changes. There are some other future actions that we think are necessary, and they include provision of housing opportunities for service workers within the destination resorts, limiting permanent residences within the destination resorts, providing nearby incorporated cities with the power to require mitigation for local traffic or economic impacts, updating the identification of especially sensitive big game habitat areas on a statewide basis. You've heard that subject in great detail today. Addressing the impacts of destination resorts on other Goal 5 resources. Addressing groundwater demands of destination resorts, including impacts on the local aquifer and present and future needs of the surrounding agricultural areas and nearby cities. Emphasizing recreational opportunities provided by natural and rural landscapes rather than the more urban or developed recreation activities, and addressing the location and number of destination resorts relative to one another and to nearby incorporated areas.
Thank you. And that is all on our list for 2011. Whether or not we'll all get there by then, we'll it'll yet to be seen, but I am going to encourage you also, because we have several planners that have been attending the work group, that you make sure and coordinate with that. Of course, the director of Deschutes County Planning, Mr. Leland, has been very helpful, and I'm assuming that you're in close coordination and working with them. So appreciate that. And make sure, please, that we do get a copy of a written testimony, if it isn't already sent, to the committee staff.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. And last up, we have Jerry Bohart from ODOT, and also Linda from League of Oregon Cities. Would you like to come up and make sure we have equal time for the counties and cities? Since you spent hours with us, I think it's important for the committee to hear. Was there anybody else who wanted to testify on this bill today? Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, committee members. For the record, I'm Jerry Bohard with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I really will keep it brief. Though we were not members of the working group, we did actively participate. I think that you heard all of the comments about the benefits of including the traffic impact analysis, and we do really appreciate that consideration. And I would just say in conclusion that analyzing the traffic impacts associated with destination resorts is critical to our understanding about the transportation impacts for both the state and the local government. So with that, we look forward to continuing to work on this issue with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities, and thank you for acknowledging me here today as a work group member. I think you've heard all the good comments by the work group members and the concerns along the way and the interest in continuing the dialogue through the interim. This bill makes some incremental changes to existing destination resort law. It doesn't rock the boat, but it was driven by a lot of give and take with in the work group process, where the members had significant differing perspectives. And to that end, the League is very supportive of the transportation and economic analysis contained in the bill. And we think you heard from Deschutes County. They have been a leader in terms of siting and in terms of their required analysis by their local ordinances. The amendment in the Dash 2 brings forward those types of requirements for other areas in the state to utilize. So the League supports the bill and look forward to continuing the process.
Thank you. Thank you for your time on the committee as well, both of you. Questions? Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1031. And for the purposes of carrying over the work session on this bill, because we have a lot of other things today on the agenda, so we're actually going to carry this over till Thursday. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1031 for the purpose of carrying it over till Thursday. We may have a very minor amendment, just some minor changes that need to come forward. But with that, I will close the work session for Senate Bill 1031, and that will be back on our agenda for Thursday. Thank you, and thank you again to the work group members who came here today. Next, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1059. Beth? Take it away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1059 is the product of the Metropolitan Planning Organization Task Force that was established last session. You should have in front of you the Dash 4 amendments. We have not yet received a fiscal impact statement on those amendments. We have received a no revenue impact statement. And I know you have a lot of people here to talk about the bill, so I don't think I'll go into the provisions of this bill.
Okay. Thank you. And colleagues, I served on the task force for this bill. We had four meetings. We do have the co-chairs of the task force work group, whatever we called it, here. And I'm going to invite them to come up because I think they probably are the folks who led this effort and are best able to describe what we have in front of us today. I want to thank both Gail and John for leading that effort, and whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Van Lanningham. I'm the chair of the allegedly friendlier Land Conservation and Development Commission. So Gail and I were the co-vice chairs of this task force. And as the chair indicated, we met four times between October and December. Had a lot of subgroup meetings, had a lot of staff work. We reached agreement on a report. We testified before this committee as an interim body in January and reported on our status at that time. It was before the bill had been drafted. Senate Bill 1059 is a result of the work of that work group. It was formed as a result of 2009 legislation, HB 2186, which directed the task force to recommend legislation to the interim legislative assembly committees related to transportation and environment, establishing a process for adoption and implementation of plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The bill with the Dash 4 amendments essentially would implement the first phase of the several phases that the task force report suggested. It creates a process for adoption and implementation of plans for reducing emissions. It requires ODOT to develop a statewide transportation strategy. It requires ODOT and DLCD to develop guidance on scenario planning and a reduction toolkit. And it requires LCDC to do rulemaking to adopt rules setting reduction targets for the regions served by the MPOs using data and advice from ODOT, DEQ, and ODE. All of those things are required to be done in consultation and cooperation with the MPOs and other state agencies. And Gail's going to talk in greater detail about those things. But it's important to note that this won't work unless we're able to work with the MPOs. The only things that this bill requires the MPOs to do between now and the next legislative session are to think about whether there are any immediate things, I know that's a demanding requirement, to think about whether there are any immediate things they could do to address greenhouse gas emissions and to look at they're already required by federal rules and funding to create a regional transportation plan, whether there's anything in adopting those plans that would help with this issue. We all agree that this is an issue that we all need to work on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gail Achterman. I'm the chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission and co-vice chair of the Greenhouse Gas Emission Task Force formed under House Bill 2186 last session. As John mentioned, there are really three things that the Dash 4 amendments do, and there were quite a few revisions made between the original Legislative Council draft and the Dash 4 amendment. You may have heard some things that were comments on the earlier version, and I think that the Dash 4 amendment has largely addressed those concerns. So the first thing that the bill would require is that the Oregon Department of Transportation develop a statewide transportation greenhouse gas emission reduction strategy. This strategy or framework is really important in order to provide the context in which cities and metropolitan planning organizations and transit districts and the State Department of Transportation are going to actually be able to develop a strategy to meet the greenhouse gas emission reduction targets that are already in statute in ORS 468A205. And specifically, it's going to provide that context by looking at the relative amounts of reductions you can get from the transportation sector using various policies and practices, the scope of the changes that various folks might have to make in terms of whether it's human behavior, infrastructure investment, whatever, in order to achieve the reductions, and the connections between what the states need to be doing, what the metropolitan regions need to be doing, what the city governments need to be doing, what the transit districts need to be doing, so that people have a clearer understanding of their role and what's within their scope. The second thing that the Dash 4 amendments direct is they ask the Department of Transportation and the Department of Land Conservation Development to work with the metropolitan planning organizations and local government to develop a toolkit that really provides the practical guidance to provide cities and transit districts and metropolitan planning organizations with the information they need about what tools are out there that they can use to actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And that's something that we heard during the task force meeting everybody is interested in getting, and no one nationally has put that together yet. The other thing that the Department of Transportation and DLCD will be doing during this period is developing guidelines for best management practices, and this is something the departments have worked together to do in the past on other topics related to transportation and land use integration, and it will help lay the foundations, the guidance and the technical assistance to lay the stage for the metropolitan planning organizations to do scenario planning in the future. All of this legislation, if you adopt it, is going to be implemented in context of House Bill 2001, which was passed last session, and which already has required Metro in the Portland metro area and Central Lane MPOs to do scenario planning. And what is also going to happen under House Bill 2001 is that we're going to adopt targets and allocate the targets among the various metropolitan planning organizations in the state so that as if and when the MPOs are funded to do scenario planning, they'll have targets that are regionally appropriate, recognizing that the contributions are very different in each of these regions, and we have to take that into account. The scenario planning is going to require extensive public outreach and engagement, and the bill also asks that the departments work with the university system to develop a statewide approach on outreach on greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector so that people have a better understanding of what they can do through their own individual actions. As with House Bill 2001, we are going to be preparing a report to the 2011 legislature after we've done all this work that would be directed by this bill to really address how much financing is going to be necessary to cover the costs of doing this scenario planning if the decision is made to go forward, and obviously that report will also update you and the public at large on what progress we've made between now and 2011 on getting the framework set up in terms of the overall strategy, the toolkit, and the guidance documents. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions? Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking back at the original bill in my comments in regards to basically the stakeholders involved in some of the discussions. And since air quality is monitored primarily by the Department of Environmental Quality, I think there's reference to that agency in the original bill, but I don't see a single reference to how DEQ would be involved in the process in regards to the amendment here.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, since we just got the amendments, I mean, you haven't had a chance to study them carefully, nor have we, but I think that the critical role that the Department of Environmental Quality needs to play is in setting these targets, and the direction for them to set the targets is actually in House Bill 2001. Mm-hmm. And so that critical function, which really has to use the air emission data, is in 2001, not in this bill. And I can't answer the question of how they might have been addressed in the earlier version compared to the Dash 4 version.
Section 5 of the original bill has quite a lengthy description of the different state agencies which are required to produce data and make recommendations for setting the targets. LCDC is supposed to set the target by rulemaking.
Under House Bill 2001.
Only after input from the state agencies that including DEQ and the MPOs.
Okay. Good question. Thank you. Because it is confusing if you aren't looking at the other,
yes.
The other bill.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, it might be useful for all of us to hear from you. You should be asking the questions, so I should be answering them, but how would you like to see DEQ involved?
You tell
I'll
she's chair of the OTC,
sorry,
right?
I'll respond to that.
The kindler, gentler Senator Boquist.
Yeah.
I think the key point I'm trying to make is that anytime you get 800-pound gorillas, and two of them are sitting up here, two different agencies, LCDC and the Department of Transportation, as an agency size and how state agencies move, many times what we find in the legislature, not just this bill or in any other bill, is we have to kind of like, okay, all six of you are going to sit down at the table and talk about it, because they'll immediately say, well, you know, we were not in the bill, and then we find out that we have a disconnect after we've spent, you know, sometimes a few dollars or a few meetings, or after we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's my concern right there, whether I agree or disagree with the policy, but that it's integrated.
It is hard to find. Chair Dingfelder and Senator Boquist, Section 5 is still in the bill after the amendment, after the Dash 4s, and that does require coordination with DEQ and other state agencies. So they are specifically named, and actually I think they're given a deadline to do certain steps, and then the commission is required to do certain steps.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, and I think that I misspoke, that it's not just the language in 2001, although it's there as well. It's also Section 5 of this bill, even with the amendments. So all that long list is still in the bill. I've been advised.
Right. And thank you, Madam Chair. When I said 800-pound gorilla, I was indicating the size of the agencies, and I think both of you have had interesting times dealing with other government agencies. So.
All right. Thank you, Senator. That's a good point. And we did have quite a bit of discussion about that in the actual task force. And you're going to hear, I think, hear from ODOT, but the fact that ODOT was very involved in and will be in implementation of this. And that's why we have Gail Achterman here as head of OTC. Any other questions? Because we do have quite a few people on the task force that like to come up and also share their views.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your leadership on the task force. I will say that this is, and maybe we should have set the stage, you know, as a member of the task force, there's a lot of discussion about best way to implement and make sure that there is coordination among the state agencies, but certainly that's something that we want to send the message. It's going to be essential, given our limited resources as well. I'd like to hear next from, we have the League of Oregon Cities panel, and that includes members that actually served on the task force. Dan Clem, come on up. Len Goodwin is from Springfield, and David Sawyer. Sorry. And Craig Honeyman, I guess you're going to kick it off. So you're going to have to squeeze in here. Not necessarily. You're going to hear. Okay, Mr. Honeyman, you want to go ahead?
Good afternoon, Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 1059-4 amendments. I'm Craig Honeyman with the League of Oregon Cities. With me today are Len Goodwin, Public Works Director with the City of Springfield, Dan Clem, City Councilor, City of Salem, and a task force member, and behind me, and will assume my seat upon conclusion of my remarks, David Sawyer from the City Administrator from the City of Turner. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the League's position and then give way to the three gentlemen who will give you the specific sort of large, medium, and small city perspective, if you will. First of all, we've been pleased to have been engaged in these discussions on this concept, on this proposal, throughout the 2009 session in the context of both House Bill 2001 and House Bill 2186, which created this task force. City councilors from four MPOs in the state were also appointed to the House Bill 2186 task force, whose report resulted in this legislation. At the outset, let me say that the -4 amendments are significant improvements over the bill as originally drafted. Our position throughout the discussions dating back to the last session, and want to reiterate them for you today, is our concern. Well, first of all, to acknowledge that that there is a need to address climate change, and that cities acknowledge, given the resources, that they can play a meaningful role in doing so. Having said that, cities are not in a position to be able to fund some of these efforts. The other point I want to make is that as we seek additional funding to deal with this mandate, should it pass, it needs to be new funding. We cannot cannibalize existing programs that are used to deal with transportation and land use programs, especially those in support of local governments. In addition, we have said all along and would say again today that there needs to be some sort of quid pro quo in place, that absent the funding that I'm referring to, that they're not, that the compliance requirements contained in this legislation not be enforced. There's been discussion in the past, and I think there needs to be more discussion on some of the ambiguities that exist relating to governance relationships or between the state agencies, MPOs, which are federal, a creature of federal legislation, and local governments themselves. We are pleased that the -4 clarifies state agency role and assumptions of cost relative to the development of statewide transportation strategies relative to greenhouse gas emissions, the development of the toolkit, the development of scenario planning guidelines, and providing public education and cost benefits regarding greenhouse gas reduction programs. So some of the pressure on local government has admittedly been reduced in terms of personnel and financial impacts. Going forward, however, I want to bring a couple of points to the table. Section 7 of the -4s require that local governments shall make determinations about immediate actions and shall consider regional transportation planned amendments. To do this process justice, we are concerned that this will cause cities to incur additional cost if they're going to really properly do the analysis that is called for. So we would prefer the changing of the word from shall to may, or delete the reference to local governments in that section entirely, until adequate funding at least is obtained. Cities who want and can afford to comply with that section and those activities certainly could still do so. Finally, we appreciate the language in Section 8 requiring state agency consultation with local governments regarding the availability of financing to cover the cost of compliance. But again, we need assurances that the responsibility of local government to comply with this program going forward is tied inextricably to the availability and the appropriation, if you will, of new funding for this planning effort. With that, I will call on Mr. Goodwin.
Okay. And I am going to ask if you do have written testimony, because we are very short on time, if you could just summarize it, please, because we have two other hearings after this as well.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Len Goodwin. I'm the Assistant Public Works Director of the City of Springfield. And as you suggest, I do not intend to read my testimony, but only make a couple of comments about some aspects of it. I certainly agree with Mr. Honeyman and with Mr. Van Landingham that the -4 amendments are a substantial improvement over the original bill. There are a couple of things I think could be done to make it even better. I agree with Mr. Honeyman that the choice of the word shall and may be significant. My transportation people this morning told me it would cost them roughly $250,000 to do the sort of planning and study that are required by this bill and by 2001. I can't tell you which part of it's attributable to 2001 and which part of it's attributable to this bill, but it is a substantial mandate on the city of Springfield as it is a member of the Central Lane MPO. We are very concerned that this effort succeed. It is very important, given the fact that we're looking at a fairly small component of the greenhouse gas problem, that this be a success for Oregon and for all cities. For that reason, we would suggest that it is perhaps important to make the focus of this effort even broader. As the information provided to ODOT, by ODOT to the task force indicates, in every MPO jurisdiction except Metro and Rogue Valley, more than 60% of the trips either begin or end outside of the MPO. If we focus our efforts on the local governments within the MPO and reduce greenhouse gas emissions through some land use activity there, we will be addressing only a minority of the problem. And in fact, we're concerned that it will actually make it worse, because there's no question that increased restrictions and standards for development in the urban core will increase the cost of housing. This is unfortunately inevitable and a cost we will have to face as a part of dealing with the threat to our climate. But the reality is that by doing that and by not encompassing a broader area, we will do exactly the wrong thing, because we will encourage development, residential development, in those cities that are outside of the MPO. And those cities, because they are in essence residential, and I happen to serve on the Planning Commission of one of them, have no substantial employment base and will end up with a large residential community that will replace the intra-MPO trips with trips from and to the MPO, which are longer and consequently create more CO2 emissions. We would urge that the task force, and Senator Axson, at least there is already a work group in progress, which Chair Dingfelder has served on, consider looking at the alternative of trying to come up with an approach which goes beyond just the MPOs, but looks at the whole area where a central core derives its commuting trips and tries to address that issue. There are other states and other areas that have succeeded in approaches like this. The concept of transferable development rights is being used in the Northeast, in New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania, to allow for the transfer of rural development rights into the urban core to create an incentive for urban development, not a disincentive, to encourage rather than mandate people to build greater density within the cities. We hope that the legislature and, if they need be, the task force explore these broader alternatives, though that in fact, when we come to the end of the day, we will have succeeded in reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Dan?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. My name is Dan Clem. I serve as a city councilor for the city of Salem. I'm also chair of SCATS, the MPO for the Salem-Kaiser area, which includes Turner, and a member of the task force. We already have a task force that will meet again this year to consider further improvements and implementation potentially of Phase 2 and Phase 3. But the life-changing experience I went through, Senator Atkinson, Madam Chair, was being a part of this task force, truly a very collaborative, cooperative stuff that ideas that I brought forward, that my MPO brought forward, were included in this bill. And so I want to thank you for that. It wasn't just another task force. It was actually a good working group. And the legislation that's come out of it, particularly the Dash 4, really represents substantially what everybody contributed to. So I will tell you, it was a pleasure. As I represent the Salem Country, Treasury Area Transportation Study. This dash four almost gets it, but it misses a couple of key points, and that's why I signed up neutral. I support moving legislation forward. I don't like the thought of having to run over to the House side and try to get changes made. We've worked so well together, Senator. I'd like us to see us fix it before we move anything forward. And with that, my first point in my letter is cooperation versus consultation. Sections 3 and 5 of the Dash 4, as it's written into the bill, uses the word consultation with MPOs, and yet Section 4 uses the word cooperation. Vice Chair Van Landingham stated it beautifully. This can't move forward without the MPOs, and the MPOs can't do it without the agencies and your leadership. I'm recommending that you take a look at replacing the word consultation in Sections 3 and 5 with the word cooperation, because that really underscores how we're going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the future. The second point is that vehicle miles traveled. I don't know what the 1990 numbers were. I've studied and I still don't understand it, but I know that with a 2% growth in population essentially since 1990, the Salem area has got a whole lot more people in it, and to try to reduce the total amount of emissions down to some figure that's being scientifically calculated, I'm not sure it stands the public test. My next door neighbor is going to have a hard time me trying to articulate how we're going to get back to what we had in 1990 with all the growth changes and all the changes in travel patterns. I would suggest that you would take a look at a per capita sort of measurement when you're looking at total emissions to the 1990 levels. I'm still not sure 1990 is the arbitrary year we ought to use. I think we ought to look at 2035 and decide how we're going to reduce emissions between now and then. I'm not sure that we're ever going to be able to have enough money, time, and effort to be able to go back to the emissions level of 1990. Congestion is just a big contributor to emissions. The traffic in Metro, the commute shed from all the way out Highway 99 into the Portland area. The cost of congestion study talked about how many cars are sitting there idling trying to get the commuters from outside the MPO into the MPO, into the Metro area. And in Salem, it's the same way with the need for additional transportation across the Willamette River. Those cars idling are creating emissions, yet vehicle miles traveled as the single standard of measuring emissions doesn't account for that. I'm suggesting that the bill that you move forward account for, and we study and make sure that we understand the impacts of congestion in terms of the total emissions. The Unified Planning Work Program that each MPO does, if it's of a sufficient size, and Salem, Kaiser, Turner is a sufficient size to require this Unified Planning Work Program. We vote on it, I think, every year. I know we vote on it every 2 years, and we establish the work that staff is supposed to do in terms of planning. One of those projects in the current Unified Planning Work Program is the Kubler Boulevard Interchange, which will feed and help support the industrial development that the state and the city and the county want out at the Mill Creek Corporate Center. If we have to redivert staff time now for the Kubler Boulevard Interchange, the next phase of that, it endangers that. It potentially, by having to use federal funds for that, it endangers our ability to purchase two more buses. With that, I want to end with the point that in the Salem-Kaiser area transportation, in this area, the biggest impact to reducing emissions is for us to figure out how to fully fund transit services. In my ward in West Salem, I have two routes. I have 16 bus stops that have no bus that stop at them now. I have multifamily housing. I've worked with LCDC and all the jurisdictions in Polk County to try to go to transit-oriented development. I've got that in a number of, we have that in a number of places. What we don't have is transit. And so to leave transit out of the mix, it can't get amended into the bill, Senator. Madam Chair, I know that, but I would encourage that we think about all the things that create emissions, congestion and vehicle miles traveled, look at sensible targets on a per capita basis, underscore that this is a cooperative effort, not a consultative effort, and that we look at funding being a problem, particularly here in the Salem Kaiser for public mass transit. With that, I know other MPO representatives are happy to continue to work on the task force, but quite frankly, in the next couple of days, happy to work with the chair and others to potentially figure out further amendment to the dash four. Okay. With that, we've got to move legislation forward, but let's get it right here.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, City Administrator David Sawyer, City of Turner. For those who don't know, Turner is a very small town, just 5 miles south of Salem, with a population of 1,700, so represents about 0.5% of the total population base in the SCATS area MPO. It's a complicated issue, but it's fairly simple for Turner. Because of our membership in the MPO, we get discluded from a lot of federal grant and loan programs because of that inclusion, and we get included in lots of regulatory measures. In this case, we are very concerned that even with the delay in requiring the plans, even with a change from the word shall to may, that the city in Turner at some point is going to have to deal with regulation implementation that we know we do not have the resources nor the funding. We will never have the resources, Madam Chair and committee members. I serve as the CFO, the planning director, the human resource officer, and the dog officer. And we do not have a staff person to be the greenhouse gas emissions staff person. We currently are working in the fourth year of DEQ regulations on stormwater that are because of the exact same problem. In those DEQ regulations, there was a 2,000 population limit threshold for exemption. At that time, when that came down, there was no city manager in the city of Turner. And I would suggest that some sort of city threshold would be appropriate, because there are 20 other cities between 10,000 and 20,000 that are not included in this legislative act. A city of 2,000 and under is probably not the intent of the original task force, nor is going to change the global climate at this point. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions from my lone committee member that has left? Don't take it personally, anybody. We have a long hearings today. Senator?
What?
Anybody?
I have no questions. Let's get vote up or down.
Thank you very much, and I want to especially thank Commissioner Clem for his comments and for your service on the task force. So I'm sure we'll be taking those to heart and continuing looking at some options as we move forward. I'm going to call up some other members of the task force. We're going to keep going here and hope that we can get everybody in and get a couple more bills heard. Mary Conley Curdy, Craig Campbell, and then why don't we have Mel Rader. Is Mel Rader here? Come up as well. Okay. Whoever wants to start first? Mary Kyle?
Hold me first.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Senator Dingfelder and committee members. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and I represented 1,000 Friends on the task force, which you've heard was a diverse group of elected officials and stakeholders, and we came to a unanimous consensus on the report that went into the bill that's now Senate Bill 1059, and we support that bill with the Dash 4 amendments. Senate Bill 1059 implements the task force recommendations for a combined state MPO and local government approach that is phased in over time and contingent on funding. The bill focuses on phase one of the task force report, and I think you heard from Gail Ackerman and John Van Landingham a good description of the elements of the bill, so I'm not going to go over those, but I want to emphasize a couple of things. First, that both the report and the bill recognize how scenario planning will be implemented differently when we get to that stage in each of the different urban areas, that they're all different and that implementation will look different. Secondly, this bill requires a report back to this legislative body with an estimate for the costs for local governments to prepare and select a land use and transportation scenario that reduces greenhouse gasses, and an assessment of how the agencies are doing in completing phase one. That means that this bill is only on phase one, that phases two and three are contingent on coming back to you and laying out a framework and a process and a funding, the funding that will be required and sources for it. You heard from the League of Cities panel a number of very critical issues that we will have to address in phases two and three concerning MPO authority and the geographical scope of the scenario planning. Those are important questions that we do have to answer, but we can't answer them until we get through phase one. That lays the basis for getting to phases two and three, and that's why this bill is focused on phase one. I also want to address the issue about potential sources of funding need to include or be exclusively new funds, and I want to just mention that federal funding, we know, is coming available for this type of planning, and including transit funding. We heard from all the MPOs that transit was important to them. You heard that again from Dan Clem, and I think that that was something that the entire task force agreed on, and that, again, this phase one lays the basis for the potential for federal funding, including more transit funding. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here representing AAA Oregon and Idaho, as I did on the task force, and I wanted to give a brief background context as to what this goal is starting off, or what this bill is starting off and addressing, and that is, as we look at the greenhouse gas reduction goals that are in ORS 468A205, it didn't designate where those reductions need to happen. Transportation accounts for between...
Excuse me, that's somebody's phone. So please, just a reminder, make sure and turn your phones off. It's not mine.
The transportation sector accounts for about 35% to 40% of the greenhouse gas emissions that occur, and so trying to take steps that are specific to the transportation sector is very important, and so the discussions began during the last legislative session to try to address those. Some of them will occur by virtue of technological changes to automobile vehicles, trucks, and so forth, so that as they move, they reduce or they emit less greenhouse gases. However, the other way of doing that is by basically affecting, forgive the alliteration, the door-to-destination decision, do I drive or don't I drive? At the beginning of the day when you're at your door, either do I have to use my car to get to where I want to go, or do I have to drive as far in my car in the future as I do today to get to my destination? Those two decisions, as they give choice to the person, should reduce greenhouse gases just by eliminating the need to drive as often or as far. There are a couple of things I wanted to comment, that this is going to be a very long-term approach because it's attempting to meld two things which, although there's tremendous amount of overlap, these two sectors, both land use and transportation, were not designed initially to work together. So there's some of that cross-interdigitation that has to occur. And as you might guess, roads don't just exist. They go from one place to another. So it's going to be a long-term process to try and figure out how to best make use of land use decisions in coordination with transportation so you can reduce the amount of travel that one has to do to meet their needs. Two other quick comments. One is that there was an emphasis on making sure that we are actively engaging the public in these decisions, which is very critical and is captured in the bill. And then finally, what Mr. Honeywin brought up was correct, and that is this is going to take revenue or resources. It's not cheap. It's not going to be easy. And in many circumstances, they're actually creating out of whole cloth the tools that are going to be needed in order to bring this about. So this is a good first start. We're supportive of the bill with the amendments, the Dash 4 amendments, and I'm thankful to the chair and the other members of the committee that served. It was dealing with such a difficult issue with a pretty pleasurable group of people to deal with was nice. And I'll end with that.
Pleasurable.
We'll see if you say that after a few more months, though, Kevin. Okay, thank you. Mel?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Mel Rader. I'm the co-director of Upstream Public Health, which is a nonprofit dedicated to promoting health of Oregonians through policy change. My organization fully supports Senate Bill 1059 because it will not only help reduce our impact on the Earth's climate, but it will also set forth a vision for a transportation system that will better support the health of Oregonians. Car collisions are currently the leading cause of death for those between the age of 18 and 35. 35, and by giving people more transportation options, we will help make the roads safer for everyone. Oregon also currently has the highest rate of asthma among all states at more than 15% of the population, and asthma is exacerbated by toxic emissions from cars, especially along the I-5 corridor. And finally, I want to mention there's a significant epidemiological evidence that links urban sprawl with weight gain in an urban population due to patterns of physical activity. And a study from Smart Growth America showed that in counties with the most sprawl, on average, people weighed 6 pounds more than counties with the least sprawl. And to put that into perspective, if everyone who's overweight in Oregon lost 6 pounds, it would save the state an estimated $206 million a year in healthcare costs. So by moving forward on the essential goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in our transportation system, we have the opportunity to also reduce several of the major causes of death and disease in the state. And throughout the process of developing a toolkit and creating local plans for meeting greenhouse gas emissions, I hope the state and local jurisdictions will take advantage of this excellent opportunity to assess the major impacts of the planning decisions on human health and promote transportation options that better promote physical activity and reduce the impacts of air pollution and collisions on human health. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions for the panel? All right. Thank you very much. Next, we're going to hear from the counties, Mike Ellison and Linda Modrell. And then we also have Stephen, do you need to come up, or can I just call Brian Campbell up? Where is Stephen?
I always need to be here, Madam Chair.
Okay, then you're going to have to wait for the next panel.
No, I don't need to.
Okay, so if we can have Brian come up, then I think that's all we have signed up for this. See if anybody else wants to come up. Thank you, and apologize. We're just working our way down the list, and appreciate your hard work on the task force.
You bet. Thank you. I represented the Corvallis area MPO on the task force. And my testimony today...
Can you state your name, Linda,
Linda
for the record?
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Linda.
My testimony will be very brief. It was mentioned earlier about the size of the travel sheds exceeding the geography of the MPOs. And I suggest that the committee consider funding the Oregon MPO Consortium to facilitate cross-jurisdictional collaboration involving the area commissions on transportation where appropriate to address the greenhouse gas emission reduction. And I also suggest that we think about continuing the greenhouse gas emission reduction task force or a body like that that also represents local governments, that be included in the legislation. I'd also like to say hello to my state senator, Boquist.
We made sure he came back to show that he's really doing the hard work.
Well, not very much of Benton County is in his district.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's a correction. The most important rural portions are.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
My constituents.
Yes.
Right, well, thank you for your service on the committee. Appreciate your comments. Mike, did you want to add anything?
Sure, just a couple of quick points. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Mike Eliason, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. While AOC was opposed to the original bill, or the original version of Senate Bill 1059, we do appreciate the work that went into this. We haven't taken a position yet, but we do definitely appreciate the removal of Sections 6 and 7 from the original version, which constituted a large unfunded mandate on local government. Couple of things that we'd love to see dealt with this bill. There are several references to OTC, ODOT, and DLCD working with stakeholders to establish a statewide strategy. We'd like it more explicit that would be working with cities and counties to establish this strategy. In addition, the new Section 7 mandates that local governments, A, determine whether any immediate action can be taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and B, consider how regional transportation plans could be amended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Both are great goals. However, there will be a cost associated with this, and no funding is identified to help with this mandate. While we are supportive of the goal of DLCD and ODOT, preparing a a report for the legislature identifying potential funding sources. We'd like to stress, as League of Oregon Cities did, that no existing funds be just diverted to this program, that new funds be sought and found for it. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take questions to the whole panel. Brian, and if you could just summarize, since we do have your written testimony.
Sure. Just a couple of quick comments. My name is Brian Campbell. I'm the representative from Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. Just a couple of quick comments. Oregon APA strongly supports the adoption of these recommendations, and the Dash 4 amendments seem to correct a problem that we certainly felt was in the original version. So I think we've been long-time advocates for past legislation that would bring climate change and energy considerations into the state planning program, and to have a continuum of state, regional, and local efforts to find effective solutions to greenhouse gas and other climate change issues. We realize it's a difficult economic environment, and we aren't in support of any unfunded mandates either. That's certainly certainly true. However, there is a very urgent need for this, and so we feel very strongly that it needs to be there needs to be some funding found either through reprogrammed efforts through DLCD or ODOT or other agencies at the state level to actually assist in doing necessary work in phase one. So that's, I think, something that we feel should be looked at pretty closely. It was mentioned before about lack of coordination. We're also pretty interested in that issue. We think that there's a problem there. We're suggesting that the governor is the head of these, nominally, of all of these agencies, and that somebody at that level needs to be brought in to make sure that all this is coordinated in a very efficient and fast fashion, because it has to happen here within a very few number of months, and I think it's important that somebody oversee that as much as possible. I think I'll just leave it at that. You do have our comments, so they're more a little more specific. I think other things could be added here in terms of assumptions, common assumptions and common methodologies, but we realize this is really just to get the program started, so we appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Great. Thank you, Brian, and I appreciate your comments. Questions for the panel? All right. Thank you very much. We have one more person I would like to testify. Brock, if you can come up. We have your written testimony, so if you can be very brief. And anybody else that would like to testify in this bill, Senate Bill 1059. Okay. Can you come up, please? Yeah. Go ahead, Brock.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. I just wanted to real briefly address some of the issues that have come up today. Again, I'm with Environment Oregon. We have 30,000 members statewide. We work on protecting clean air, clean water, open space. This has been a long process.
Did you say your name? Am I?
Brock Howell. I think I started.
Okay.
And then I...
Okay.
Anyhow, yes, I did, and then I said the organization a little bit later. It's been a long road down this process of to get to where we are now. It started with a governor's task force on climate change. It went to House Bill 2120, switched to House Bill 2001, went through House Bill 2186 last session, a task force, and we are here today after a lot of process. And to be honest, we're going to be engaging in these conversations for quite some time down the road. But I think how the task force has come to a resolution thus far is going to be informative of how we go forward from here. Consensus-based, continuing to be open to each other's discussions and issues, and then slowly resolving the many problems brought up, whether it is figuring out what the targets are for reducing greenhouse gases, figuring out what the region, from what area we need to reduce the greenhouse gases from, finding funding for transit and how we integrate land use and transit in the future, developing modeling tools, developing the toolkit. All these things are going to be developed over from in different stages from phase one, phase two, phase three. This gets us going down that road. It doesn't solve all the problems that were raised today, but it certainly opens up that dialogue to continue. And for that reason, we strongly urge the passage of Senate Bill 1059 with the Dash 4 amendments to make sure that we continue to have this productive dialogue.
Thank you, Brock. Welcome. If you could state your name, please.
Hi, Joel Batterman. I'm here on behalf of the Cascade Climate Network. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. The Cascade Climate Network is a coalition of students in high school and college at campuses on more than a dozen campuses in Oregon and Washington. Our statement of principles calls on us to build a sustainable, just, and prosperous future for all, and we're happy that SB 1059, as amended, promises to take us towards that goal. I'm not sure I need to tell the committee about the harm global warming is doing our future, but I would like to emphasize just how profound that change threatens to be, especially over the lifetimes of young people like myself. And I hope you understand the urgency that we attach to action. We're glad to see this bill under discussion because it addresses a part of the problem that we've really yet to confront, and a part whose resolution promises to improve our communities in a host of ways. Beyond its benefits for the climate, this legislation will produce a more affordable, reliable transportation system for all Oregonians. When transportation costs are already our second largest budget expenditure, we can't for our households, we can't afford to make Oregon families spend increasing amounts of time and money behind the wheel. As for myself, I'm not sure how I'll ever repay my mother for the many hours she spent shuttling me and my teammates to soccer practice. But by constructing communities where transportation alternatives are more plentiful and long commutes less necessary, we can ensure that these burdens don't fall even more heavily on members of my generation, in addition to the added problems of climate change. For all these reasons and many others, we're confident this legislation represents an essential first step on the path to a clean transportation system, and we hope very much to see it pass this month. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here today. Do you want to say a quick few words before I close the public hearing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, through the record, Doug Riggs. I wasn't going to testify, but I do want to echo, on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization, comments made by Dan Clem of the City of Salem and also the representative from the City of Eugene on this bill. We believe that it is a good start, but there are improvements that could be made. And in particular, I'd like to give you one example of the difficulty of reaching the 1990 targets. As you well know, Bend in 1990 was approximately 19,000 people. Bend today is 77,000 people. So the difficulty of getting a city of 77,000 folks back to the emissions levels of 1990 when they had 19,000 people are a challenge. So that's one of the things I'd like to be considering as we move forward in the process. And I just wanted to raise that for the record.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. And with that, we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1059, and there will be more discussions on this bill on Thursday, and it's posted on Thursday for a work session. We have, is Senator Figueroa here?
Not.
Okay. Okay. Yes. So just to let folks know, we are going to try, we have two more bills up, 1036, which I thought was going to be a very quick bill, but we can't find the bill sponsor, and Senate Bill 1055, which we are now going to get the bill sponsor, and we're probably going to start with that. We are going to try, we have a half an hour left. I am going to try committee members to see if we can hear everybody in that short time. So I'm going to ask, we have a lot of folks signed up on Senate Bill 1055. I'm going to ask folks if you could please, again, if you have written testimony, summarize your testimony. We're going to try to make sure that we can get everybody heard here today. And as soon as we have the bill sponsors, we will get started. But I think what we'll do first is why don't we go ahead and open up Senate Bill 1055. We have a couple of folks here I know from came out of the building. We want to make sure that we get them heard. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1055. And Beth, if you can provide us with an overview, please.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1055 would authorize wineries as outright permitted uses in exclusive farm use zones under specific conditions. You should have in front of you a Dash 1 amendment and also a Dash 2 amendment.
Okay. And why don't we go ahead as soon as Senator Winters gets up here? Okay. And we'll have her introduce the bill, but we want to have... Okay, so I'll ask Ted Farthing and Gary Conklin to come up as well. we can get started, and as soon as the senator gets here, we'll have her jump in. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 1055. I'm Ted Farthing, Executive Director of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, which represents Oregon wineries and vineyard operators. And I want to thank Senator Winters for introducing Senate Bill 1055. The issue of what wineries can and cannot do in exclusive farm use zones has become an issue in a number of Oregon counties. One county issued an enforcement order telling an individual winery to stop activities that the winery had conducted for nearly 20 years at its tasting room along I-5. The 1989 Oregon legislature enacted land use provisions specifically relating to winery activities in exclusive farm use zones. Those provisions allow commercial activities at wineries incidental to the sale of wine. While the provisions expressly permit a limited service restaurant operation at a winery, lawmakers in 1989 stopped short of describing or limiting incidental activities. The idea was to give counties the flexibility to make those decisions. Now, counties and others are calling for clarification of state law. After much internal discussion, OWA supports an amended version of Senate Bill 1055 that would do one thing: define incidental activity at a winery as private events hosted by the winery or patrons of the winery that promote the sale of its wines. Gross income from these incidental activities may not exceed 25% of the winery's total income from on-site retail sales of wine. This language clarifies existing law with a maximum revenue amount from incidental activities at wineries. The 25% number parallels the limitation for farm stands. The 25% limitation won't permit wineries that are effectively event centers to operate or be sited in EFU zones under Oregon land use law. A broader conversation about special events and commercial activity in EFU zones is needed for all agricultural land, and the OWA commits to be part of that larger conversation. Meanwhile, Senate Bill 1055 addresses an immediate problem faced by Oregon wineries and county officials in Oregon's wine country. We urge passage of Senate Bill 1055.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Winters, I apologize. We got started because we're short on time, but jump right in.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and for hearing Senate Bill 1055 for the record. My name is Jackie Winters. I reside in Salem. I represent Senate District 10. Just a little background on Senate Bill 1055. I agreed to introduce and sponsor this bill at the request of Marion County, and I did so and did a placeholder back, I believe it was in December. What has occurred in Marion County, and I don't know if any of my members here addressed that issue, but we have a situation where we have a statute that needs further clarification in order to allow one of our major vineyards to continue what they have been doing for 20 years. And that is providing food at events. And I hope he's here in the room.
He has signed up. So
did he sign up? But our planner, our local planner in Marion County, had actually did a cease and desist order because his interpretation of the statute was not clear, and as a result of that, he actually ordered to stop the activities here in the valley and to decommission its kitchen. And that enforcement order had I can't tell you what effect it has for us here in Marion County, particularly this particular vineyard who has signed up. So the bill is actually designed very narrow to just fix this problem. And I also recognize, having gotten into this, to fix this problem, that there are probably other problems out there. And I would encourage you to pass this legislation, but I would also encourage you to actually convene others to look at the other problems that are out there. Because I keep hearing other instance of issues that relate to the wineries, that relate to fruit stands, that relate to this, and everyone has some interest. And I recognize that probably we don't have the time during this session to address all of them, but I do encourage you, Madam Chair, to convene a work group to begin looking at other issues as it relates to not only the wineries but farm use, just from what I have been able to receive just from dealing with this particular issue. And others will talk about why this is necessary. It was interesting to me that here we have had an event, an industry that has been in existence for the 80s, and until today this issue hadn't raised its little head, and that is the issue of retail. And yet vineyards have been engaged in it. Like I said, this one is narrowly defined so that Willamette Valley Vineyards and those who are actually doing retail can continue to do so. And I would urge a favorable vote out of here so that, you know as well as I do, our economy is suffering right now. We certainly don't need to have another bad linchpin in an industry that has served us well. So, and I know there's, if you haven't heard from Mr. Conklin, he can probably add.
Would you like to add anything?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I'd only add that the amendment that all of us are referring to is the Dash 1 amendment, which I believe council has and you should have in front of you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions here?
Yes.
Okay, Senator Brzozinski, do you have a question?
Jason, go first.
Senator, yes, go ahead, Atkinson.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Farthing. Mr. Farthing, what happens if a winery exceeds 25%?
Well, as we understand it, this bill would set a ceiling at 25%, so it would not allow that kind of activity to continue.
Well, but what happens? I mean, will they just take it in cash? I mean,
well, it's meant to limit the revenue from beyond the sales of wine at retail under that level. Gary, do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, this bill does not establish any new remedies beyond which counties already have to enforce their land use provisions.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I'm a sponsor of the bill. I support the bill. But so here's a situation in Southern Oregon. So the new winery is created, and they're not going to see any sales for, I don't know, 6-7 years off those grapes. And they start doing weddings, and they do 2 weddings in the winery. And they charge a lot of money, and they make, I mean, a little bit of capitalism is a good thing. So people get married, they go off into marital bliss, and they pay the winery, and the winery now is making more money off winery, or excuse me, off the 2 events that they did that summer than they did off the sales of grapes, which produce wine off of retail. Are they going to jail? What happens?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I don't know that they'll be going to jail, but they could today, with or without this bill, face administrative actions by the counties. And in fact, some of our wineries are doing that. There are wineries that anticipate the circumstances that you have suggested or others that don't attempt to be permitted use wineries and may either seek some kind of a zoning change or some other type of a special use or conditional use permit to allow activities that are outside of what is permitted. This is, as Senator Winters indicated, a situation of where it's hard to describe the norm, but what we're trying to do with our own industry group is to try to find a balance between where the majority of members are relative to their principal activity in an EFU zone, which is to grow grapes, process those grapes into wine, and hold tasting rooms and some incidental activities that help promote the sale of their wines.
That's fine. Just to follow up, I wish we would address that question, because I think that the question I asked is the real linchpin as we try to support wine tourism, especially in Southern Oregon, in these small vineyards are facing. You know, there's opportunities out there to do well, and we're going to limit it from some Willamette Valley land use interpretation. I think it's a little silly, but I still support the bill.
Senator Brzozinski, did you have a question?
I got 2 questions mm-hmm. to start off with.
on the dash one in conjunction with is being substituted for the word by. What does that mean?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, this is actually the language that's in current law, other places in current law that relates to wines produced on a site. When we worked with legislative counsel and Senator Winters on the original placeholder draft, the phrase was put into Senate Bill 1055, produced by, which is actually a new phraseology. So in conjunction with actually conforms with other parts of existing law that deals with wineries.
So does that mean that you bring grapes in that aren't part of the winery that's then produced into wine?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, it really doesn't represent an extension of what you can do. It actually is a reflection of how wineries talk about the production of wines. There are some wineries that do custom crush activities. This doesn't really raise that issue. We're just trying to make sure we don't inadvertently create new definitions that have to require new case law.
So if I can follow up. So you got a winery that has a production of over 100,000 gallons. What are they?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, it's as you have read the statute, a winery that would exceed 100,000 gallons in production, annual production, is not specifically referenced in Oregon land use law. So by its omission, presumably it would need some type of a special or conditional use permit to exist. This is law that is, we're not touching, we're not changing. It's a very interesting question, as Oregon has seen the growth of some of its mid-sized wineries into wineries that are either at or near, and in a few cases over 100,000.
So what's your opinion on the dash twos?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, I actually have not seen the dash twos, so I apologize. I don't know what they are.
And the gentleman in the middle?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, we haven't seen those.
Do you have a problem? Let me just follow up with this. Do you have a problem of identifying a winery beyond what's currently in statute that currently says that you're a winery if you have a less than 50,000 gallons, or you're at least 50,000, but no more than 100,000.
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, I'm not sure. It would probably help if I could actually see the amendment.
Yeah, we'll make sure and get you the amendment. I think we're going to have to follow up
because
they don't have it right in front of them. So I think we'll need to do that, and then we can have them come back after they've looked at the amendment. Is that okay, Senator?
That's fine.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. All right, so we've got 15 minutes left right now. Senator Ferrioli, I see, is back there. What I'm going to do is, should I recess this?
Are you going to come back?
Yes. So before, Senator Pozanski, before you leave, I just want to make sure who can come back at 5:30 today so we can finish.
Wherever you need me.
Yes, can everybody?
Mm-hmm. We're going to go for 3 hours.
No. We'll go from 5:30 to 6, most likely. That's it. Okay, so I just want to let folks know what I'm going to do right now is recess this hearing. I'm going to open up. We have only three people to testify in Senate Bill 1036. We're going to do that, then reopen this hearing. Anybody who cannot come back tonight will make sure that you come up and say a few words, and then we're going to recess until 5:30 to continue this so we can finish this up today. Okay. So with that, I'm going to recess Senate Bill 1055. I'm going to open up Senate Bill 1036. Senator Ferrioli, if you could come up and introduce your bill, and then we'll get the other couple of folks up. And thank you. Sorry, we're running short on time today.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you very much for hearing the bill. Appreciate it very much, and also for the opportunity to present Senate Bill 1036. I believe it's a very simple bill. In 1997, we saw this legislation create the opportunity to establish guest ranches under very specific conditions in eastern Oregon. In those conditions, we're essentially offering the bill today that makes no changes. We're simply lifting the December 31st, 2009 expiration date of the bill. 1036 would allow guest ranches to be established on units of land at least 160 acres containing a dwelling of the individual that is actually operating the livestock operation. Guest ranches would be limited to 10 overnight guests, lodging units per 160 acres, and for every additional 160 acres of land, only five more units may be established. The law sets a maximum of 25 total units on the land mass totaling 480 acres. The bill would allow guest ranches to provide recreational activities, excuse me, pardon me, Madam Chair.
So, Senator, I'll just make sure. So nothing is changing except for the sunset date. Is that correct?
Same bill, Madam Chair.
Okay. That's all we need to know.
Thank you very much.
I'll save you from that. So thank you. Are there any questions before we call up a few folks who want to testify on this? Okay.
We had one question from this side of the...
Yes, please.
It better be quick because we have a lot of people waiting.
A defibrillator?
A defibrillator.
We have somebody up here who's very adept at the ministry.
In the building.
Yeah.
I believe there will be other buildings.
Hopefully.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. You can stick around in case
if
there's a question.
If you don't
mind, certainly.
I would like to
Mark Cushing, I'm going to ask everybody to come up. If you could, Mark Cushing, Eric Kanzler, and Sean Cleave. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mark Cushing. I'm from Portland. I represent Sylvie's Valley Ranch, which is halfway between Burns and John Day, straddling Grant and Harney counties. We're an example of a current Eastern Oregon guest ranch. My clients, Scott and Sandy Campbell, are from Burns. Built a terrific business in Portland, the largest veterinary hospital group in the world, sold it, returned to Harney County and Grant County, and have a 45,000-acre ranch, which included a severely malnourished ranch as well as a relatively malnourished guest ranch. They put significant funds into it. The statute is a very simple way for ranches in eastern Oregon to, A, augment income, which is not easy to go by these days, and secondly, provide folks from other parts of the state and the country a chance to take a look at an existing livestock operation. We have, at any given time, about 4,000 to 5,000 head of cattle and had 5,000 tons of hay last year, so it's a meaningful ranch. This is a nice bill that lets that happen with some guest amenities.
Thank you.
And briefly, Madam Chair, again, I am Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Due to the very limited nature of Senate Bill 1036, Oregon Farm Bureau has no objections to the current bill. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. And if you could trade seats with Eric, that would be very helpful. Thank you. Stay up there.
Okay,
I think this is going to be quick. Yep.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Eric Kanzler. I'm the Executive Director of Central Oregon Land Watch. Here to offer some comments on Senate Bill 1036 related to guest ranches. As a matter of general policy and after careful review of the history of guest ranches in eastern Oregon, we're inclined to be supportive of this bill. We spend a considerable amount of time working to protect natural resources throughout the state, and so we also feel a responsibility to promote responsible economic use of those lands. So far, there are 11 guest ranches that I'm aware of that have been approved throughout eastern Oregon. According to DLCD's report, seven of those are still operating. A few have gone under. A couple have turned into B&Bs. These developments truly are overnight-oriented and not associated with any land divisions. So from our perspective, they provide a legitimate means for livestock operators to, you just heard this, augment the income they receive from livestock operations and help preserve that particular use of rural lands. There are, however, a very limited number of lands on which we and other conservation interests feel these sorts of developments are somewhat inappropriate and perhaps in direct conflict with established conservation priorities. Specifically, we're referring to private inholdings within federally designated wilderness and wilderness study areas and a number of formally recognized conservation priorities throughout eastern Oregon. So we've been working with representatives from the Oregon Natural Desert Association, which is a nonprofit that's primarily involved in the federal protection of lands, to develop language that would properly identify the most at-risk lands and help develop a policy that would be, presumably, from our perspective, a win for the economic policy portion of this bill and also a win for conservation objectives relating to a very few number of private lands in eastern Oregon. So I realize that we're already a week into a very short session, and bills have to be out of this committee by Thursday. I don't know if there is enough time to amend the bill while it's still in your hands. Perhaps there's not, although I do have language, draft language at hand if you're interested to see it. So we're supportive of doing this as a matter of, as I said, as a matter of policy, but we'd also like to address the conservation issues as well. At this point, if the issues can't be addressed in this committee, we would be interested, if the bill is to move along, presumably to a House committee, to see if there's any interest in addressing those issues there. If those issues are addressed, we're very supportive of this bill. If they're not addressed, we'd likely stand opposed. So that's all. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? All right. I was going to say that if there are concerns, probably given our short session, you're probably going to have to look at the House side.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else would like to testify in this bill? Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1036. We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 1036.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 1036.
We have a motion to move Senate Bill 1036. How do you want to move it?
With the due pass recommendation.
Okay. To the floor with the due pass recommendation. Staff, we fiscal on this.
It's a minimal fiscal, so no statement.
Okay. And I wanted to see if there's any discussion. Hey, I'm just going to say for the record that I heard that there are some concerns. I've talked with the folks from the Central Oregon Land Watch about that, and I said I would be happy to talk to the House Chair about this issue, and certainly will, given the short time that we have. So I appreciate you bringing that forward, and it'll be as we move forward with this bill. I do think that the DLCD report, I read that, and I thought that it was a good summary, but certainly there are some issues that need to be addressed. But with that, we will see if there are any objections. Okay, seeing none, motion carries. And Senator Ferrioli, I will assign you an abstention as the carrier of this bill, unless somebody else wants to.
Well, it's a perfect person.
Okay. So with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1036. I will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1055. The reason is, as I mentioned, we're going to go a few more minutes. If there's anybody that is here that cannot come back at 5:30, because we will continue the discussions at 5:30, make sure that we hear everybody. Somebody raise their hand. Come on forward. All of you, raise your hand. Just come up towards the front.
Sit by.
Well, you're the agency, so you cannot come back.
Jim?
The member from the Board of Agriculture.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Got it. And Janet, I know you're here. Can you come back at 5:30, or do you want to come up?
No, I can if you need me to. I'd rather have Jim Bruno.
Okay. 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 Why don't you go ahead and get started, and your name for the record, please.
My name for the record is Pat Dudley. I'm a member of the Oregon State Board of Agriculture and the chair of the Land Use Subcommittee of the State Board of Agriculture. I live in Polk County. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. The State Board of Agriculture Land Use Subcommittee has been talking about the issues of agritourism and agritainment, if you can stand that word, for quite a while as very high priority concerns for land use issues in general affecting agriculture. In December, we brought a resolution, our subcommittee brought a resolution to the board, which passed, I think it was unanimous, after some heated discussion. And we have given you a copy of that resolution number 299 that we passed in December. The resolution addresses our position on the siting of agritourism, entertainment, and associated activities on agricultural lands. Please note that the resolution supports such activities only under strictly defined circumstances. Included in the resolution is a listing of considerations for developing what circumstances the board believes should be the focus of siting such facilities. The board has asked Department of Agriculture staff to work with stakeholder groups to better define the circumstances when associated commercial activities are appropriate on agricultural lands. This issue is very complex. It's much bigger than the permitting of occasional events on agricultural lands. And it's also important to note that the issue encompasses more activities than just those associated with vineyards and wineries. And as stated in our resolution, the Board of Agriculture advises a comprehensive evaluation and analysis of the issues of agritourism and entertainment in agricultural lands before any actions are taken in this area. The board suggests that any legislative action be evaluated and targeted for the 2011 legislative session.
Thank you.
So that was a resolution of the whole board. And Jim Johnson, I'm sorry I didn't introduce on Board of Agriculture staff to answer any questions that you might have that I can't help.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming here today, and I certainly appreciate your willingness to look at the big picture. Jim, thanks for being here. No? I called up Jim Bruneau.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry, because I want to make sure that everybody came from, and are you able to come back at 5:30?
No, that's what I...
Okay, so Jim, can you step down?
Yeah.
Jim Bruneau can come up. But you can stay up. I want to make sure everybody who can't come back, and you have about 1 minute each, because we are going to be kicked out of this room, frankly. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Bruneau. I'm the founder and president of Willamette Valley Vineyards, and I appreciate very much the county and you taking this matter up in this special session. I appreciate the forbearance and regulatory action that the county planner has taken so that this matter may be considered in the special session. The activities that we engage in are incidental to the sale of wine, or a very valuable marketing tool for our company we've engaged in the last 20 years. And we understand what the importance of why the county needs more clarification on this issue, because they're facing applications, new applications now, and they would like to have legislative guidance as to where to draw the line. The line that's being proposed, we believe, is a reasonable position to take. The Oregon Wine Growers Association has debated the issue and felt that this is a reasonable position to take: 25% for incidental related activities in the sale and promotion of wine on site is would be able for our winery to continue to operate without it suffering harm.
Well, we have your written testimony, so thank you very much for that. And I was going to say, you're welcome to come back at 5:30 if you want to hear the rest of the testimony on this today. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dingfeld. My name is Bob Horning. I am owner of Horning's Hideout. We're a private park north of North Plains. I have myself been allowed to do weddings on my place because we are a private park. There is a process, land use process, currently right now underneath ORS 215 to allow such activities. Currently, parks are not allowed on high-value farmland, such as, you know, some of the wineries and everything. Some wineries are, some wineries aren't. The process is already there if people want to take advantage of it. What needs to change, or what could change, very simply, and this is on some stuff I gave you here, is to change a couple sections of ORS 215.23 and ORS 215.283 and move E up and also another section up into where parks are allowed in high-value farmland. Now, there is a concern with agriculturals and everything else about having events on private farmland and everything. Well, what could simply for high-value farmland, we could put in a clause there, limit the size of the park, 4 to 4.5 acres. You know, this would allow the wineries to take part of the property, what they want to use for weddings, and change it into a private park. Now, it's allowable, that way it'd be allowable by law, but it wouldn't intrude on the rest of the agricultural. You also keep in the clause there that the wineries, or this here would still fall underneath ORS 215-296, which would make sure that the wineries are not infringing, or the parks are not infringing on other farmlands uses. And there's balances already in place that can be used here if it was used. The work session that was brought up would be a very good point here as far as getting people down. But I think this here would be actually a simple quick fix, actually, if possible. Now, 10 years ago, I came up to the Winery Association and tried to get this done. And back then, because I, like I say, I own a private park, McCulloch Farms in Washington County was at that time being regulated out of business. They just did weddings on their property.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to need you to wrap up because okay. I have two more other people and certainly. We have 2 minutes left.
Well, yes. Anyway, the wineries have fought special status for their neighbors. When Measure 49 came along, they were a heavy contributor to Measure 49. It shouldn't be a special interest legislation here. This should be allowed for any farmer, anybody, anywhere. Wineries, they claim themselves as farmland. If they want that, then they should go through the process of, you know, ORS 215, 213. And I'm not against it. I'd love to help out and make this happen. I mean, I'm shooting myself in the foot because I say I'm already able to do wines. I mean, not wines, weddings and everything, so.
Okay. All right. So, thank you for your testimony.
Sorry.
John?
I'm John Miller. I'm the owner of Mahonia Vineyards and Nursery in the South Salem Hills. I don't own a winery, but the wineries are critical, obviously, to the independent vineyards because that's where we sell our fruit. So I'm very much in favor of 1055. It's a simple, easy fix for a real problem that exists today. There's a real temptation, I think, to take this much broader, as Pat Dudley mentioned, and there are other issues, but I urge you to seize the day and grab this one while it's out there for you. I chaired the state wine board for I served on it and chaired on it for a couple of years, and I know how difficult it is to get the winery folks to agree on something. It's kind of like herding cats, as they say, and the statewide organization supports this bill, and I agree with it. The communities, as well as the wineries and the economy, stand to lose at this because the wineries have always been extremely generous with their facilities to nonprofits, and I've chaired a couple of statewide nonprofits and currently helping plan two events there that are fundraisers, one for an environmental organization, one for a children and families organization. And this issue, I think, threatens the viability of doing those sorts of things, and some are already planned and scheduled, so I think you have an opportunity to fix this with a real rifle shot and do something else in the next session in terms of a broader fix for other arenas.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Just one quick question, Madam Chair, for the board. Because I think what I heard you say is we don't want to do anything. We want to wait till the next session. Correct me if I'm wrong, but we're going to lose 128,000 people off unemployment, and this state's going to look like the Dust Bowl shortly. So is there anything the Board of Agriculture is willing to do now to try and prevent further job losses in this area?
I don't think that the board anticipates there would be any job losses by not acting until 2011. Nobody's been put out of business yet on this, as far as we've been able to determine.
Okay. Here's what I'm going to do. We have, who else cannot come back? Is that it? Just one person? Why don't you come up? And Janet, you come up too, so you don't have to come back. What I'm going to do, just so folks know, the rest of the folks on this list, if you are able to come back on Thursday, we will finish off the hearing first thing, and then I need to open up and carry over for the work session as well. So I think we'll be able to do it, so we won't have to come back at 5:30. Thank you very much for waiting and for your patience. So whoever wants to go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Jess, Thousand Friends of Oregon, and to keep it short, we would oppose this bill in its unamendment form, and the -2 amendments would make what we think is a bad bill worse. The -1 amendments go a long way towards addressing our concerns. However, we still have a couple of concerns which we've conveyed to the wine growers and have not yet heard back. In particular, the 25% limitation, while a noble attempt, we think is impossible to administer and enforce, and we think another mechanism has to be found, and that's probably simply can't be done in the time frame we're working on.
Okay, thank you. Janet, thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. Thank you, first of all, for the opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1055. I don't have opinions on the various amendments or really on the content of the bill specifically, because I'm not a technical expert on wineries and I'm not a technical expert on land use. But what I will say is, first of all, the reason that this issue arose in Marion County is if you have a winery in Washington County, Yamhill County, Clackamas County, Marion County, you're probably going to get a different answer from your planning director on how you handle these incidental sales. The law is very unclear right now. In Marion County, we operate on a complaint basis, so that means someone that's been doing something for 20 years could do it for 20 years, and until someone complains, nobody's going to do anything about it. But then we had a different winery that couldn't understand why they were enforced upon, and so then they made a complaint against Willamette Valley Vineyards, and here we are. We had a workshop at the Association of Oregon Counties, and Jim Johnson was there, as well as Sean Cleave and Gary Conkling, and it is, there's a lot to this, and it's very complex. We see this particular bill as the short fix for the specific issue of defining what incidental sales are, whatever the parties can agree on. The broader fix in terms of all farmland, lavender farms, parkland, the other things that you've heard, that's going to require a work group and a whole lot more work than can be done in the special session. So I don't think it's an either-or is what I'd suggest to you. I would suggest that you can look at this bill narrowly, help us clarify what the incidental sales are, and then move forward in the next session with a work group. It's very possible, though, that that work, as you know, won't come to fruition in just one session. It could take two. And then meanwhile, we're still trying to figure out across the state how we handle things, and it's not a level playing field across the state for wineries. So I would urge some action on this bill in this special session and also get the ground laid for doing some broader work around all farmland as the Department of Agriculture has asked for.
All right. Thank you very much, Janet. Appreciate your perspective. Anybody else who is not able to come back? I only have three people that will be carried over till Thursday, including the Association of Oregon Counties, DLCD, and Farm Bureau. Okay? So with that, I'm going to close this public hearing, and please do not leave yet because I have to do a work session open and close. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1055. We will hear this at 1 o'clock on Thursday. We will continue the public hearing and work session. It'll be a work session. And then right now I need to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1032 for the purposes of carrying that over till Thursday. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1032. Anything else, committee, staff?
No, you're good.
Okay, with that, you have a reprieve from being here this evening, and I'm going to close the Senate Environment Natural Resources Committee. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah.